Good morning. My name is Linda, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon since 1987. And I feel very honored to be up here with this AA rat pack. What I know about the river this morning, it didn't care it was daylight saving time. It just kept on rolling. And what I know about the Flint River Roundup is that you may have given up the drink, but you didn't give up the party. This has been a fantastic weekend. Thank you so much for allowing me to be part of it. Now, this is a panel on sponsorship. And Al-Anon doesn't do a lot around sponsorship unless you give it a nudge. And let me tell you, from this pamphlet on detachment, it says, alcoholism is a family disease. Living with the effects of someone else's drinking is too devastating for most of us to bear without help. So when I got into Al-Anon, lots of years ago, there wasn't too much said about sponsorship in the Al-Anon meeting, and we realized that we needed to buff that up. So we would make sponsorship a topic at the meeting. We didn't know to ask for a sponsor. We didn't know how to use a sponsor. We did hand out a phone list of people's phone numbers that you could call. Now, when I asked my sponsor to sponsor me, I was absolutely petrified. But what I loved about this lady is that she looked healthy, she looked happy, and she did things with her husband. And that's what I wanted, and that's what I wanted in my life. And what I know about this woman is that she told me the truth. She told me things like, you can't tell the difference between a hangnail and a death in the family. She took me through the steps. She said, you're going to do this, and it's going to be like the guy that took his army to fight, and they came by ship, and when they landed, he said he had them burn the ship because he says there's going to be no retreat. And that's how she took me through the steps. I was going to go through those steps. There was going to be no retreat. She also had very good boundaries if I called her with my emergency, which was usually that he was late for dinner. And I would call her, and she said, I'm in the middle of fixing my dinner. You're going to have to call me back. And what was so amazing, once she gave me a little bit of time, my emergency had gone away. She also told me to keep some money and a set of car keys hidden, so if I had to get out of there in a hurry. So I guess what I'm saying about sponsorship is that this woman loved me when I didn't think I was lovable. She cared for me when I didn't think anybody else did. It became a contract between two women that became very successful. I don't know what else to say about sponsorship other than I believe in it. We have a pamphlet that says sponsorship. I don't think it's encouraging much in Al-Anon. It is in AA. And I appreciate the opportunity to be able to say that. I believe in God. The first time I was taken through the steps, the big book is not conference-approved literature for Al-Anon. It wasn't then, but we had very little literature back then, and she took me through the steps, going through the steps using the big book. In fact, it was the big book that I'd purchased and that I'd underlined and read everything I thought my husband should read. And you know, what you just did, laugh, that's what my sponsor taught me to do. She taught me to laugh. And she taught me to be present in my own life. And for that, I'm extremely grateful. And with that, I'm going to sit down. Thank you, gentlemen, for letting me share the panel with you.
Good morning. My name is Kent Coleman. I'm an alcoholic. Sobriety date is May 18th, 1992. Home group is Venice. Sponsor is sitting right there. I just did a two-hour workshop on sponsorship in Detroit last weekend, so I'm going to condense that to 15 minutes. Right? I was glad that this was the topic. I'm going to say something right off the rip. The original sponsor is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous went out in the mail to people who had no benefit of human contact with anybody in this program. They read the black print on the white page in the blue book. They did what it said, and exponential growth occurred in Alcoholics Anonymous. Read the foreword to the second edition. 50% at once, 20%, 5% after some relapse. Some came back. We're talking 75, 80, 85%. an unbelievably high rate of success, and we experienced exponential growth for a long time in this fellowship. All over the world. Book went out, no benefit of human contact. So the first thing that I need to know is that as a sponsor, everything that I need to know to work with somebody new is contained in that book. I do not have to make anything up. I do not have to invent anything. My problem centers in my mind. I don't think too many people are interested in my opinions. So I know, right, where the directions are. I know what works. I think one of the troubling things today is a lot of people are challenging the very tenets of what we know works here. Well, sponsorship ain't in the big book. Why should I have to have one? Have you heard that kind of nonsense? Because it's going on. While our rate of recovery plummets and people are dying like crazy in here, we're challenging the very tenets of what we know works. Personal sponsorship, as we know it today, began in Cleveland. Didn't start in Akron, didn't start in New York. 1939, Alcoholics Anonymous begins to explode in the city of Cleveland. You got less than 100 members in 4 years around Akron and Cleveland. Less than 100, right around 100. Took them 4 years. Series of articles comes out in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Dilworth Lumpkin writes a pamphlet called Mr. X about Clarence Snyder. That was the first pamphlet that we had. And that pamphlet goes out. But this series of articles in the editorial section of the Cleveland Plain Dealer ran for an entire week. And all of a sudden, all these people start, inquiries just start pouring in. First member in Cleveland was a guy named Clarence Snyder. Clarence Snyder, Bill Wilson said, was the biggest ball of energy that this fellowship ever saw. Dr. Bob and Bill are watching what's going on in Cleveland. And if you read AA Comes of Age, which I highly suggest, Wilson said, we were extremely skeptical. It took us 4 years to get 100 people. They got 100 people coming in every month. And he said, we didn't know. We stood back. What Snyder did, and this is where personal sponsorship came from. In the first big group of people that came in, they got rooms like this. They did something that had never been done before. It's 1939. Akron and New York are both still attending Oxford group meetings. The book is not being used for personal sponsorship. The book was written primarily for two reasons. Number one, they try to make a few dollars. Y'all know that story, right? And the second was to preserve the integrity of the AA message, which was being changed by word of mouth. That's why they wrote the book. The book in 1939, they weren't using the book. They were still reading the Bible at Oxford group meetings. Snyder puts people in a room like this, takes the book and starts taking people through the steps out of the book. There were less than 20 guys sober in Cleveland at that time, and they were just deluged. They couldn't work with people one-on-one. There wasn't enough of them. So when they took this first group through, what they told them was this. Okay, now you guys have to work with the next crew that comes through. They're just pouring in here. And so the ethic of personal sponsorship, as you know it, was born of the necessity, right, of this influx of people into Cleveland, particularly in 1940 and 1941. My grand sponsor was a guy named Ted R., who was a big Russian vodka drinker, came in 1941. Back then, my sponsor had three guys work with him. And all of them came in 1941 or 1942. And Neil came in at the age of 23, and he was the youngest guy to come into Cleveland. Snyder didn't want to mess with him, so he took him down to Akron and gave him to Doc. And he said, Doc, because Doc was his sponsor, and he said, this kid is too young. Most of these people are in their mid-40s, early 50s. We don't even know, right? And Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, had just gone off into the service. And Dr. Bob and Ann fell in love with Neil. And Neil, who was my grand sponsor, who I sat with every Thursday night at Thursday Men in Cleveland, lived with Dr. Bob and Ann for a long, long time. And Doc sponsored them. The ethic of personal sponsorship started right then, and it was born of the necessity. If you read page 22 in AA Comes of Age, it said this early thing in Cleveland proved three things that are vital and crucial to us today. First off, the value of personal sponsorship, which had never been before done. You just came to the Oxford group. They took you through a series of spiritual principles they introduced you to at the Oxford group meeting. That's the way it was done. There was no one person who worked with you. So the first thing they learned was the value of personal sponsorship. Number two, the use of the AA Big Book in indoctrinating newcomers into recovery. That's the second thing that they learned. That if you take them through the black print on the white page in the blue book and they do it, they stay sober. And third, that Alcoholics Anonymous could continue to grow in a healthy fashion using those two things. And those were three things that prior to this point in our history, no one knew. So if we need to know what to do today, this is the value of our history. Any time that a society fails is because it forgets where it came from. We don't have to reinvent the wheel in here. It's already been done successfully. Okay. So as a sponsor, one of the things I do with my guys, they read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, pass it on, and AA Comes of Age. And I don't care if it takes them 10 years to do it. I don't care if you read a line every day. It doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that you do it. How can I expect the men I sponsor to be productive? So we always sit around saying, we want to pass the torch to the next generation. The next generation doesn't even know what this is. How do we expect them to do so? I take them through the traditions. I take them through the concepts. And I don't sit there and read the service manual to them, right? Just in a fun way. Now, I sponsor people in a lot of different places. And what I do with a lot of them is I have them gather their sponsees, grand sponsees. We'll take an hour and a half. We'll do a Skype. And we'll do a thing on the concepts. And they'll ask me questions, right? And we just have a little interplay. There's a lot of ways to do this stuff. We got people sitting in meetings. We're talking about stuff assuming that they know what we're talking about. They don't have the faintest idea. As a sponsor, I need to take responsibility for this. Well, all these groups ain't got no GSR. They don't know what it is. I did a workshop at home on, I did one on traditions for our district, and I did another one on the concepts. I'm thinking 30 people, hopefully, right? There's 120 people. And the first thing I said to them is, you guys are hungry, aren't you? And they were like, mm-hmm. And there were 40-year people in there. Not just new people. So we've got great opportunity today, you know, based on what's going on, to continue, right? To share this message and to share these things. But I say about sponsorship, Ann Smith said something that really, she said that when a man starts working with others, we cease to worry about him because the needs of others will drive him back on God. It's one of the most beautiful things. I had that hanging in my office at home. How many times, and I'm sure you've had this experience, you talking to a sponsee on the phone and something comes out of you that you didn't know, right? And you thinking to yourself, wow, I should write that down. I'm going to need that next week, right? Why would that happen? Why would Ann Smith make that statement? This is just what I believe. There is no time in my life that I am closer and more availed of the power of God than when I am looking eye to eye with one of his kids and trying to help. I believe that is as close to God as I ever get. That is when I am most yielded to God and His power. That is God's will and God's purpose for me active. When a man begins to work with others, the needs of others will drive him back on God. Right? I'm a guy, I said it yesterday, I sponsor like crazy. I work intensively with other alcoholics. I've been on the phone half the weekend, right, whenever we got a break. They go crazy when I leave home. When I'm home, everything's fine. They're like, is he gone yet? Let's call, right? The joy of my life. The joy of my life. I want to say something. This, when I was taken through these steps, and I was desperate enough, didn't really know what I was doing, just like any other new, but I was desperate enough to do what my sponsor told me. I was sponsorable enough just to follow these directions. It lit something in me. We're talking here about our state of being. This is not intellectual. This is of the spirit. And my desire, I started looking at new guys, and this is what I started seeing. Wow. Boy, look at him, look at his family. Boy, if he did this, he's so gifted. He's so talented. I wonder what God could do with him. It flows. It's not something. I don't say, well, if I want to stay sober, I better try to help somebody. No. Man, my heart just, it just, it's natural. I've never had a guy, and I work with a lot of people, do this to the best of their ability, and then I had to force them to go find somebody. Usually I've got them by the collar saying, wait a minute, it's almost time, right? Because it's this thing, it's in the spirit. It's born of spirit, this desire to serve. Because God is love. This awakened spirit is just to awaken the love in you. Love serves. Love loves. It serves. That's what it does. So I love working with people. I love to watch the transformation. And not just in a family. But I said something yesterday to some people about numbers. Because people ask me how many people I sponsor. And the answer to you will be none of your business. And the reason is because if I told you that, there are people in this room that will attach importance to that number. You know what the big number is? Just the big number right here. If God can use me to assist one person in their recovery, how far do the ripples go? How many people is that guy going to help? What's going to happen in his family? What's his family going to do? Because see, where I come from, and I'm grateful for these conferences, got Alan out here, because where I come from, where Alan started in Akron, we ain't separate. One of the first things my sponsor made me do was get Al-Anon phone numbers, Al-Anon meeting schedules, and Al-Anon literature, and put them in the glove compartment of my car. They're still there today. I require that of everybody that I sponsor. When you go to see that new guy, I don't know what that guy's going to do, but I'm going to tell you, you get some information in the hands of that family, and you'll be surprised how many families will jump on it because they're sick and tired of suffering, regardless of what the alcoholic does. He may never get sober. Get some help to that family. How far do the ripples go? In a community, at an employer, a place of employment, they start bringing guys. One person, how far do the ripples go? Right? What a gift we've been given here. Sponsorship, like I said, I did 2 hours on it last weekend. I ain't going to do that this morning. I'm almost done. People that I sponsor are the mirror to my soul. They keep me in front of me. How many times, and this, I can be honest here this morning, You got a guy call you, he's sober a year and a half. He goes, you ain't going to believe what I did yesterday. I'm thinking, yeah, I will, because so did I. Right? ain't nobody in here, right? We all got feet of clay, right? And now I got to call him, right, and tell him I got to fess up, right? This is what's going on. Because it's just the whole thing. We grow together. We learn together, right? And I go to meetings, I be trolling for new guys. That's what I do, right? Here you are, here come Kent, right? And when we was in Michigan last week, Scott said something, because it's something, the same thing I do. We don't give out our phone number. We get phone numbers too. Because if you anything like me and you knew, I ain't calling you. They told me go get phone numbers. I went and got them. Man, I don't even trust myself. I'm not calling you. I don't know you. Call some stranger, right? So we wait a day and we call them. Do that sometime. They'll talk for 45 minutes, right? But they can't get past themselves enough to call you most of the time. Every once in a blue moon you get one to call you, but most of the time they won't. Right. So I go to meetings, I look for people. When new people raise their hand at my home group, we immediately engage them and we start talking to them about getting put in place. Okay? Because if we look at our history, right, we know what's effective, we know what works, right? In those days, in the early days, they will hospitalize a guy. They run a bunch of guys at them, giving them their drunk-a-log, right? So then on Friday, they come in and say, well, what do you think? And the guy goes, well, whatever they got, I got, all right? Then they would say, well, do you believe in God? And the answer would always be the same, like, well, no, we didn't ask you all that. Do you or don't you? Well, yeah, okay, let's ask them for some help. Boom, they hit their knees, they said a prayer. That's the first three steps. When that guy left the hospital and they took him to a meeting, when he walked into the door of his first meeting, he had already been engaged with sponsorship. He was already engaged in the process. He already had a support group. That's the guys that had came in and talked to him, and he's walking into his home group. All those things are in place at the first meeting, and you wonder why they had such a high rate of success. Okay? That was the doorway to Alcoholics Anonymous then. The doorway to Alcoholics Anonymous today is your home group. And they usually come in with a piece of paper in their hand. My question to you is, because a guy said to me, we don't have 12-step calls no more. And I picked up one of them pieces of paper and I said, yeah, we do. And here it is right here. What is your group doing with this? What are we doing to replicate the experience as a group? What are we doing to replicate that experience that we know produced a success rate of somewhere around 85 or 90%? I challenge you with that. God bless you. Thank you.
Morning. I'm Scott Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And honored to be here. This is, I think, the fifth time I've followed Kent in 10 days, and it is the last. And, Dad, I swear my guardian angel has taken some time off. I swear. Beautifully done, sir. Thank you. Thank you, and Linda, too. Beautifully done. Share a little bit out of the blue book that he was referring to. I don't find the word sponsorship in what I call the basic text, which is from the very beginning through the end of Dr. Bob's story. But I find the concept of sponsorship laid out, I think, beautifully in two sentences on page 96. They've been talking for several pages about a 12-step call. And we left in the book, and it says, suppose you're now making your second visit to a man. So the first one was, a couple of us showed up, we laughed, we cried, we left him a book. It says, so now for me, we describe someone who is sponsorable. He has read this volume, says he's prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. So there again is the definition of the program. And I love the language, you're prepared to go through with the 12 steps. Okay, that'll be good enough. We don't get too many eager ones. And then oh boy, steps. Gee, that looks like fun. And then for me, we describe sponsor. It says, having had the experience yourself, Give him much practical advice. What experience? The experience of going through the 12 steps? What advice? Advice on how to go through those 12 steps based on my experience of having done that. And to me, that wraps up sponsorship pretty closely. I had an experience. My fifth sponsor very inconsiderately died and left me without a sponsor, which I have not forgiven him for that yet. His name was Don Roy, and he was just a great in Nashville. And I thrashed around for he went home to die. They had the conversation in the hospital, we can make you comfortable, get your affairs in order. And I got, with 11 years, not sober long enough to figure out that he's going to be gone and to start looking for a sponsor. He dies, and I'm unsponsored for about 2 weeks, and I'm crazy. And I thought, I'm looking for a sponsor, don't know what I'm looking for. But I inventoried the five men who had sponsored me at that point. I thought they were different as individuals. They had common characteristics. And I asked myself, what are the common characteristics of these fabulous men who have sponsored me? And here they are. So this for me. I'm not selling this. Whatever you do suits me fine. For me, the characteristics of an effective sponsor are as a sober man. I don't sponsor women. Women don't sponsor me. I know some people do it very effectively. That's not in my bailiwick. It's a sober man who's actually done the 12 steps. If his mission is to coach me through those steps and make sure that step work stays solid, at my home group, they say you can't anymore give away something you ain't got and you come back from somewhere you ain't been. So he's going to have to be someone who's done the steps. Needs to be somebody who has a sponsor himself. Hopefully, he surrendered to somebody. Definitely, we have a plan when I bring him the question he can't answer. A good sponsor will tell me the truth I don't want to hear. And I think that's a really important thing, that he's a lot more interested in saving my butt than my face. And that's important. For me, a good sponsor is active in service work. He is going out. Everyone I know that I think has this message is going out of their way somehow that somebody else gets a shot at it. From showing up early at the meeting to make coffee, to taking meetings, to working on committees like this, to carrying meetings into corrections. They're doing something. That what they've got is so big and so beautiful, they don't have a choice. That they have to be out there trying to help somebody else get it. And the sixth characteristic is that they laugh a lot. And as strange as that may sound, my experience has been that people who do these 12 steps, that life just gets kind of funny. And if you'll watch them in meetings, they're grinning when not very many other people are. So if you're new, you don't have a sponsor, let me suggest, watch for one of these people that's grinning in meetings. Go up to them, smell their breath, and small sniff, and then ask them, do you have a sponsor yourself? Have you done the steps out of the big book? Now, if you're new, you're probably thinking, gee, I'd be uncomfortable doing that. I'd like to suggest that you embrace the idea of being uncomfortable. Because if you're like me, doing what makes you comfortable is how you got here. So one of the givens for me in recovery is I'm going to have to do some things I'm not comfortable with. And ask them. And allow them to coach you through doing this marvelous process. The other thing that I do is I'm willing to be counsel to the men that I call, but I don't want to make their decisions. As I talked about it yesterday, my experience is that a mistake is just an invitation to a lesson. But I want to help them have as many options as they can. So I get a call from a particular guy one day, and he writes TV shows. You've seen some of them. And he's crosswise with his producer one more time. And I said, okay, what do you think your options are? And he said, well, I guess I could just go in there and tell her off and quit. And I said, oh, that's an option. I said, what else? So I guess I could just hunker down and take it. I said, yeah, that's another option. You could do that. What else? He said, that's all I can think of. I said, well, I got a couple more options you might consider. You could get a 12-gauge and blow her head off. Let's talk about that. All right? And we can discard it. He called me months later with another fight. And he said, I was fighting with her again. And I thought I ought to just kill her. And he said, I started laughing in the middle of the fight. So now we talked about that. We're not going to do that one. I said, another option. Commit suicide. Jump out the window. What floor are you on? He said, second floor. I said, that's no good. That's just a broken ankle. How about you could go back in there and tell her that I don't think we had a clear communication. I may be at fault here. Can you lay this out for me again? How about talk to or email one or more of the other people who were in that meeting and ask them what they heard and see where you're off base and what's really going on here. Lay out several options. And then he chooses. And as long as he doesn't choose one that I think is out of bounds spiritually, which is really the only thing I can say, that what you're about to do is out of bounds spiritually, it's not, then he has to choose because he's the one that's going to live with the results of it, not me. We'll talk for a moment about how God uses a giant ego like mine. A number of years ago at our what we call our usual suspects, it's a men's retreat we do outside of Nashville. And we couldn't sell all the seats, so we comped in. So there's a small men's treatment center. We comped the patients in there. And one of them is a fellow named Oleg, who's from Kiev in the Ukraine. And he comes to me one night and he says, "Would you get me a sponsor?" So I go to the executive director of the treatment center, and I said, who I happen to be sponsoring, and I said, "What are Oleg's chances?" He said, "We can't break his ego. There's no hope." But I prayed about it that night, and my ego said, "This is a shot at the entire Soviet Union, and you are taking it." So at breakfast the next morning, I announced to Oleg that I would be his sponsor. He still reminds me frequently. He never asked me to sponsor him. He asked me to get him a sponsor. And that was 11 years ago. And I had the privilege of taking him through the 12 steps and got him through before he went back to Ukraine. And I told him to find a sponsor there. And we stayed in touch. And he said, "There are no sponsors here. They've had the big book in Russian, which they all speak, for a number of years, actually since the mid-80s, I think, when Don Pritz took it over there. And but he said, they don't know how to use it. And every time I speak in a meeting, they line up like I'm a circuit speaker. Where did you get that? How do I do this?" So I continued to sponsor him. And what a joy it's been. I've had the privilege of, Lynn and I have been once, I've been twice to the Soviet Union, going again this summer to do workshops very simply on my experience with the 12 steps. And but I get a call from him, I guess a year and a half, 2 years ago, and he said, "I got this guy, I got through the steps, and I've told him it's time to start sponsoring," and he says, "He's not going to sponsor. What should I do?" And I said, "Drop him." I said, "We can't afford to waste you." He said, "No, you don't understand. I mean, I really love this guy. He's a really good guy." I said, "Oleg, let me explain to you a different way. If you don't drop him, I'm dropping you. I don't have a lot of things I set in stone, but I sponsor sponsors who are sponsoring sponsors. They're either sponsors or sponsors in training. That's all I work with because it's the only thing that works. And we can't afford to waste you on a dead-end street." Well, he understood that. And that guy today is sponsoring 10 or 12 and doing fabulous because Oleg explained it to him. And so necessary. My own take on that is that I start the guys I sponsor sponsoring when I get them to step 8. By that time, they have some message. And what I'm hoping he's going to say is, "I want you now to sponsor somebody." Usually they say, "I'm not ready." I say, "I hope you don't ever think you're ready. I hope I don't ever think I am. I hope I don't ever think I don't need divine help on this every time. And we're going to find you a rookie." And it's like Kent said so beautifully, you start exchanging phone numbers with these new men and calling them a couple of times in the next 3 days. In a month, you'll have more than you can swat. They'll be all over you. And the way we're going to do this is you're going to get blanket permission from him to talk to me. Everything, blanket permission. And I'm going to coach you through coaching him through these 12 steps. And we'll do that as many times as we have to. A fellow I love so dearly in Nashville, I sponsored him for a lot of years. He just could not, the fourth step would not stick in his mind. He'd sit there looking at the page and he just couldn't see it. I don't know how many times I coached him through coaching somebody through four. He's got it now. He's doing great. Proud to do it every time. I asked Don Pritz on two different occasions what a sponsor's primary responsibility was. He gave me the same answer in different language. One time he said it was to maintain the integrity of the message. And the other time he said it was to not allow the sponsee to settle for relief, but to get him all the way to recovery. And it's really the same thing, isn't it? And what I've discovered also is that by the time I get somebody to step 9, his life has changed. Right? He's been promoted at work. His bills are being paid. His key fits in the front door. When he walks in, they don't scatter. The phone rings. That's a miracle. He answers and admits it him. That's another miracle. He's sleeping in the big bed again. So a lot of his motivation is gone. And he's willing to settle for relief. My job is to keep him moving into recovery. And one of the things that keeps him moving is he's sponsoring this new guy. He does not want the new guy to get to 8 before he finishes 9. And it's been very, very useful for me. It just makes my job easier. I like things that make my job easier. Don Roy gave me this when I asked him to sponsor me. He said, "I'm going to tell you how to drop your previous sponsor." I like the term drop. It's what the book uses. And he said, "Thank him." So I called Mike up on a Friday. I left him a voicemail. I said, I need to talk to you. And he returned my phone call on the following Tuesday afternoon. and I was in the middle of a divorce. There's a reason I was changing is I could not get him on the phone. And I said, Mike, thank you. Thank you for all you've done for me. Thank you for all I've learned. Thank you for all the effort you've made on my behalf. I want you to know that you have been a tool in God's hand in my life. Thank you. And it's only fair for me to tell you I've asked somebody else to sponsor me. All right, where he could detonate at that point. But if he does, that tells me I've done the right thing. And I tell the men, as I take a new man on to sponsor, I say, you're coming in well, leave well. And the way you do that is when it's time for you to change sponsors, and you probably will, you just thank me. You will go with my blessing. I have a single thing that I'm a mission for the men that I sponsor. My mission is to take them to a place spiritually where they have to go on to somebody else to go further. Take them as far as I can take them so that they have to move on to somebody else who can take them further. How could I be unhappy if they got there? It would mean I accomplished my mission. I wish I could remember to do it every time. I'd probably be bad in the 800s on this one. But when I talk to a guy I sponsor, I say, let's take a moment and invite God into this conversation. I did that with somebody here. And we just take a moment. And you say amen when you're done. I'll say amen when I'm done. Okay, amen. And now let's talk about whatever it is. I've been the victim of fabulous sponsorship. I hope you are. God bless. Thank you.
I'm Bob Bureau. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I hope you're, as my friend Larry says, if you're new here, I hope you're prepared to be divinely inconvenienced. I got sober at a time and place where there really wasn't any big book consciousness. My home group was a big book group, my first home group. But they would read half a chapter of the book and then talk about their stories or what's their day. And there was no laser-like focus. And the first time I ever encountered that was in 1980. Late 1980, I heard my first Joe and Charlie workshop. Changed my world. But I'd started sponsoring people when I was brand new. The book said... This is used negatively by some people. The book says we can't transmit something we haven't got. And that's true. But you don't have to worry about that because you can't do it anyway. Right? Just transmit whatever you do have. And when I was new, I was not even a week out of detox, and my first sponsor started pushing me to do 12-step work. And he wanted me to take meetings back into the detox that I just came out of. He wanted me to sign up for a new meeting that was going to be started fairly soon in the prison. He wanted me to do service. He wanted me just on and on. Get on the 12-step list, start going on 12-step calls, look for new people to welcome and help. And I understood what he was saying. But I said to him, because I'd had a lot of therapy and I knew I said, well... don't you think I should work on me for a while? And he looked at me, he said, work on you. You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. And he said, just go help people. And I said, all right. I was sponsorable. And so I started from the very beginning. I was a week sober. And I started getting involved, doing service, and it changed my life. I don't know that I would have survived. And I had nothing to give away. I knew to get people to meetings. I knew where there were good meetings. I knew that. I had some simple fundamentals. I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist. But my sponsors got me praying, which I thought was silly. I told him, I said, I don't believe in God. I can't pray. And he said, I didn't ask you to believe in God. I asked you to pray. And I said, well, if I prayed and I didn't believe in God, I'd be a hypocrite. And he said, oh, you've been a hypocrite all your life. What's the difference? Just do it. And I started doing it. And so I started telling other guys, just pray. And they'd say, well, I don't know if I believe in God. Oh, that just make me happy. I'd just go, well, you don't have to believe in God. And just do it. And I can only transmit what I had. And then some things happened to me. I started sponsoring guys, but I don't know what I'm doing. I'm making every mistake. I'd never studied the chapter, which is a sponsorship manual working with others. I'd never studied that chapter. So everything in there it says don't do, I pretty much did it. Everything it said do, I didn't get around to that. You know, I was like a cowboy shooting from the hip. And if you don't have principles, all you can lead with is ego, because that's all I got, right? But I got a couple principles. Get to meetings, pray, be transparent. My sponsor was big on being transparency. Be transparent with people. You're sick as your secrets. That was one of the big sayings that went around in the 70s. And so I had all that. Get involved in service. And I was sponsoring a guy named Andy Henry. And you know how you do? Sometimes you connect with guys. I mean, really connect with them. And Andy and I were so much alike. We were like cut from the same cloth. And we'd spend hours in Denny's coffee shops talking about our lives and talking about AA. And the more hope I tried to transmit to Andy, the more hope I had that AA would work for me. And I don't think Andy ever got that hope from me. But as I tried to transmit it to him, I got it. And isn't that a fundamental principle here? We get what we give, right? And Andy called me up one night. And I said, I'm not doing, man, very well. I'm thinking about drinking. And I said, did you pray today? Yeah, he prayed. Did you go to a meeting? He said, I went to two. And you're calling your sponsor. Well, that's about all I had for him at that point. I didn't have anything else. And so I didn't know what to say to him. I said, well, just pray again. Get down on your knees. And go in the bathroom. Get down on your knees. Pray. And go to another meeting. And he went to this other meeting, got out of the meeting, and he, the obsession to drink was on him. And I had never helped him put anything in place to ward that off, to infuse him with enough grace that was, anyway, Andy drank again. He came to, he could not face the idea of coming back to AA again. And raising his hand, and he had a Kawasaki 1100 motorcycle. He went out to the old Lancaster Pike down in California. He got it up to what they suspect was about 110, 120 miles an hour. Waited for an oncoming tractor trailer truck coming 70 in the opposite direction, and painted himself on the front of that truck. And I remember going to, I was just devastated. I remember going to his funeral down in Lancaster, California. A bunch of us in AA went down there, and I was one of the pallbearers. There wasn't enough of him left to embalm. They had a little bag in there, and they couldn't even embalm it, so you could kind of, it was a weird smell. I'd never smelled that before, smell of death, right? And I remember sitting in that chapel, and I'm crying, and I'm thinking to myself, man, I can't stop helping people. And I knew that because I'm a depressive. And I discovered exactly what Bill Wilson had discovered. The freedom from the bondage of self in helping people. And I didn't know what I was doing in helping them. But I got something from that I needed to get. Because I'm a depressive, right? And I knew I couldn't stop doing 12-step work. But my God, I didn't want to ever be in this situation again, because I knew something inside of me. I didn't want to know it, but I knew it. I knew that whatever he needed, I didn't have it to give to him. And I'll tell you, Andy, that did something to me, and I started really trying to get into that book as if it was a set of directions. And the next, I think that shortly after that, I heard my first Joe and Charlie, and I started to really get into this book. When I was about 30, must have been about 30, it's been 30 years now ago, I found myself in a situation where I was taking guys through the book and having a lot of results. And I found myself in a position where I had all these new guys that needed to go through the steps. And logistically, it was impossible. It was more guys than I could one-on-one take through the steps. And so Don Pritz from Aurora, I was talking to him, and he gave me the idea. He said, well, why don't you take them through as a group? And so every Tuesday night at my house, we'd meet. And we'd go through the book. And if it said ask, we asked. If it said listed, we listed. And we just did, we read it as if our lives depended on it, and everybody did what it said. So when we got to step three, everybody pair up, do a third step. You had a week to do resentment. You had a week to do fears. You had a week to do sex, which is usually, most people, it's about a minute and a half. See, I got that voice, and I see it, and it leaks out every once in a while. I am my favorite comic and my favorite audience. And so we do that, and it was spectacular. Everyone from that first group, and it was somewhere between 10 and 15 people, I think, I don't know anyone that went through that drank again. And then they all said to me, they said, well, can we bring people we sponsor, and we'll do the same thing. Let's do it again. And so it started in my house, and for several years, it was a hands-on workshop where if you wanted to come to this, that's great, but you've got to be willing, you got to agree to do what we're going to do. And then it got bigger, and guys were bringing their wives that were in the program, and that meeting still goes on. It's now up to like 70 to 80 people in my house every Tuesday night. And we outgrew my house once, moved to a church, and went to we came back to the house, and now there's people. The hall is full of people. The dining room's full of people. And we can only get about 65 chairs in the living room, so it's packed. And we do that only. It's not a hands-on workshop anymore. It's too big to do the one-on-one stuff. But we go through the book, and we've been doing that for a long time. And now we have rotation, because that's the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have two people that sit on the couch, and they share their experience with whatever part of the book they're on. And then everyone, the second half of the meeting, gets to share only on that. If you don't have an experience with that, that's fine. But we're asking you, if you don't have experience, to pass. Just talk. So it's a laser-like focus on the solution, and we spend quite a bit of time on the traditions. About 20-some years ago, 25 years ago maybe, 20 to 25, I had a guy I sponsored came up to me one day, and he gave me a present, and it was a box of business cards, right, that he made for me. And it was a sweet thought. And what he had done is, I hadn't realized it, but in Midland, I think it was in Midland, I'd given a talk down there, and in the talk, I said there were five essentials to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he literally copied it from the cassette and put it on the back of the business card. I forgot I'd had these, and I just found the box again. I hadn't used them in a while, and this is the essentials. It says, to stay sober, you must form five habits in your life, and these are non-negotiable. First habit is the meeting habit. If there's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere in your city, and you don't absolutely have to be somewhere else, go. Go to fulfill your primary purpose of looking for somebody to help. And, you know, it's not about quantity as much as quality and attitude. I have guys I sponsor that they have big lives running business. And there was a time when I had 25 employees. I had two stepkids living with me, plus my daughter, a wife. And I still found a way to go to meetings. You got to be creative. One time I was working 8 in the morning to midnight. And I would take my lunch hour and go to, there was a meeting in a Denny's in the back room. And we'd eat lunch and have the meeting at the same time. And then I started a 12:15 midnight meeting. Inconvenient time. I'd have to go with about 4 or 5 hours sleep, but it was there for me, because sometimes I'd get off work and I need a little infusion of God, and I can't get it directly alone. I got to get it with being with you. Because God speaks to me. He's always talked to me in the group conscience, through the meetings, through the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I'm awake. And so it's not about quantity as much as quality. The attitude I tell guys, I said, listen, it's your job to see how many meetings you can go to. Find a way to fit as many as you can in your life. If you can only fit 3 or 4 a week, and that's the best you can do. I know guys that can only get to 3 or 4 a week, and I think they're more willing than the guys that are retired that could go to 2 a day. It's not about quantity. It's about approach. It's about a demonstration of willingness to show up so to catch God's grace, to show up to opportunities of other-centeredness. The second habit was the God habit. And that's I have to have conversations with God every day. And this has shifted in my life over the years. And everything shifts. Certain things that I were absolutely adamantly sure of 20 years ago, I'm not so much anymore when it comes to sponsorship. But these five essentials have never changed. You need to develop a relationship with God. And it says in here, even if you don't believe in God, do it anyway. Take the actions. It's an amazing thing if you present yourself to the power, even if you don't believe the power exists. The power comes the other 9 yards. And you will have an experience. Every atheist, every agnostic that I've ever encouraged to do that, and they did it, came to believe. If you show up and you do that. And the third habit is the accountability habit, being transparent. You know, that thing about we're as sick as our secrets is really true. I have to have at least one person. I've always had more than one, but I have to have at least one person that there's no secrets from. And if I have someone that I can't be transparent with about everything, even the slimy little, you know, and there have been times in my sobriety where I've done some things. I shouldn't have done that. I have to be transparent about that. And if I don't have a sponsor I can be transparent with, I got the wrong sponsor. And I love my sponsor. I mean, he shocks me. He just shocked me Thursday. I think I know what he's going to say. Sometimes I go to him and I've done something, and like this last Thursday, I did something I shouldn't have. I don't know. I didn't feel that great about it. I shouldn't have done that. And I thought he was going to just slam me. He was the kindest guy. I've gone to other times where I've done something so magnificent that they should build a statue of me at GSO. And he'll cut my legs out from under me, right? Because he's very intuitively awake to ego. And he can see things in me that I can't see. And I need that kind of sponsorship. Because I get full of myself. I know that doesn't happen in Georgia, but I get full of myself sometimes. And I don't know it. That's the crazy thing. It's just like it says in the book. We are extreme examples of self-will run right, though we usually don't think so. They're not talking about your first year. Right? 30, 38, 39 years sober, and I usually don't think so. Because I have an excuse justifying, rationalizing machine that can make the most, as Silkworth says, we can't even differentiate the true from the false. Whatever is my alcoholic life will seem normal to me, right? I can't trust this. So I'm accountable. Service, that I have to do something for some of God's kids, and I have to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always had a job in AA. It was hammered into me that I must serve this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether it's getting there early and helping with the chairs or having a commitment as a secretary or an intergroup rep or a GSR or a DCM or conference committees, on and on and on. I serve Alcoholics Anonymous and I try to help God's kids every day. There's never been a day in my sobriety since probably a couple months sober where I haven't been talking to people on the phone or at meetings that I sponsor and I'm trying to help. Never been. And that is the channel to freedom right there. Because left alone, I'll just implode into myself. And I have to do that. And then last is big book. Is that I should be doing something in the steps and something out of the book every day. I still do. Right now, I read out of the book. I won't say I read out of the book every single day. I probably 4 to 5 days a week. But what I do, and I've done it so many times for so many years. The page 86 and 87 they're stuck up in here. And every night I go through those questions. And on awakening, I go through the procedure, the contemplations, and the prayers. And I do that every day. And I think that's real important. But the main thing is to work with others. And everyone up here has said that. You know, that's if you want to actualize God's grace in your life, you have to sponsor people. And I know a lot of us get scared about that. We're afraid. We're afraid we're going to say the wrong thing. We're afraid we don't have. And a guy told me when I was new, I said, I don't really feel ready to help anybody. Because I didn't, man. I felt like an empty shell. I got nothing here. And he said, just do it. And I said, but I'm not ready. He said, if you wait until you feel like you're ready before you try to help someone, you'll have already died of alcoholism. Just do it. And I push the guys. If you ask me to sponsor you, you're going to be sponsoring people. You're going to be doing service. And I will help you to do that. I will tell you how to do it. First thing I said, I went into guys that are sober 20, 30 years, and they're depressed. And there was a time in Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about in the book, when we had but two alternatives. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation. And that doesn't even necessarily imply drinking. You can do that in your sobriety until you blow your brains out. Right? Or to accept spiritual help. Well, we live in a society that we are marketed to by pharmaceutical companies now. So now there's three alternatives. Right? See, it didn't used to be that way. It's like you got to get deeper into AA or die. And it's not necessarily that way today. But it's that way for me today. And it's that way. And I try to bring the point home to the people I sponsor. That is a temporary solution. But don't you want more than that? I know right now you don't believe God's big enough to handle you. He is. Trust me. He's big enough. He's big enough. And the only way you find out that God's big enough to handle all your problems is to present yourself unconditionally to Him like that. It's not easy. Scary stuff. And so these guys that are 20 years, we're losing them. We're 20 years to 40 years, we're losing people in AA. Probably 6-8 a year that I hear that have died, drank again. And I go to some of those guys and I ask them, if I can, can I help in any way? And I start talking to them. And I always ask them, so how many guys do you sponsor? And I've heard this several times in the last few years from people that were sober a long time that are depressed. And so I don't really sponsor anybody. Why not? And they say, well, it's not my niche. What do you mean? It's not your niche. Well, I sponsored a couple guys and they all drank. Well, so you come to the conclusion it's not your niche? And then I got to tell them about Bill Wilson. And December 15th, 1934, Wilson gets out of town's hospital with a conviction that came as a result of after his spiritual experience lying in the hospital bed. And it came to him, this thing that he's got to help people. He's got to help drunks. That's all he knew. And he came out of that hospital with an awakening and a conviction to get into action, helping other drunks. And from December 15th, 1934 to May 10th, 1935, Wilson went through 96 failures. 96. 96. And so you had three failures. I think you got 93 more to go before you can draw the conclusion that it's not your niche. And there's a spiritual principle. If you throw enough crap up against the wall, eventually some of it sticks. And I teach guys how to throw crap. First thing I say, find a fishing hole. Find a well-stocked pond of new people. Detoxes are good. Recovery houses, treatment centers. Sometimes jails, if you have access to them, where you can actually, there's a possibility that there's people there that need sponsors. And then go over and go in early. Get there a half hour early. Chat some guys up. Get around to the idea of sponsorship. Tell them how important it was to you. Then ask them, do you have a sponsor? And if they say no, say, listen, I don't want to impose myself on you, but I want you to know it's very important for my recovery to help people. And if you would want to be sponsored, and we can have a conversation if you do about that, I would be my honor to help you. And here's my number, and get their number if they have a phone. A lot of the new guys I work with don't have phones. They don't even have a place to live. Right. Sometimes guys are living in the bushes though with cell phones today. That's an odd that I can't get my head around that. I mean, why would you get what you paid for that cell phone would have been two cases of wine, for God's sakes. But you know, it's crazy. And then you do that, you'll see something every once in a while light you up. You'll see a person's face change because they have been battling with their own self-centered fear for some time to get a sponsor, and they're too afraid to ask anybody, and you just solved their problem for them. And I can promise you, if you did that once or twice a week, at the end of a year, you'll find yourself in a coffee shop with a booth full of people you sponsor. So it's my job to show up. And it's a work in progress, you know. It's if it wasn't for me sponsoring guys, I wouldn't have survived my own sobriety, truly, truly. And it reaffirms my faith in God. Sometimes I get stale. I just do. Sometimes my relationship and trust in God gets flat. I get used to it. You know, it's like the enthusiasm dims in me sometimes. But if I got new guys and they're coming to me with problems and I'm throwing them back to turn towards God, because I'm not there to solve their problems. I'd end up a newcomer in Codependence Anonymous if I start solving your problems. I'm there to help you access the power and to give you the actions to take. And I've had this happen dozens and dozens of times. Say weird things to guys like, well, I know you look, I think you think you're going to go to prison. Maybe you are. But what? Pray about it. They look at me like, oh, Jesus. Just pray about it. And they do it. And all of a sudden something weird happens. And it's like they don't have to go to prison. Right? It's very, and it's like, oh my God, this thing works. It's like, wow. It's like the story of the Catholic priest walking down the street. He gets to the bottom of a big hill and he looks up and there's this little kid on a tricycle up on that hill. And he thinks, oh no, this kid is not coming down this steep hill on that tricycle. There's a bump at the bottom. This is bad. And sure enough, here comes that kid barreling down that hill. Oh, and the priest is going, oh my, oh no, this is horrible. And he hits that bump and flips over and tears his pants up. And he's got a bloodied up knee. And the kid gets off and goes, God damn it. The priest goes, son, don't say that. That's blasphemous. Don't say that. Say, God bless me. And the little kid goes, oh, okay, Father, okay. And they both go about their business. A week later, that priest walking down that street gets to the bottom of that same hill, looks up. Here's that crazy kid. Oh, my God. Oh, no. Don't. Oh, here he comes. Oh, he's really coming this time. And he hits that bump in the bottom of that hill, flips over, the front wheel of that bike is crushed in. His pants are all torn up and bloodied. And the kid gets off the bike, looks at the priest and says, God bless me. And the wheel straightens out. The cuts go away and the pants just come together. And the priest goes, God damn it. Right? And have that experience sponsoring guys where you go, oh my, there really is a God. Oh, who knew? I forgot. I fell asleep. I forgot. Right? And it's the people that I help that help me. I'll tell you one more quick story. My 11th year of sobriety was probably one of the most difficult years. I went through a divorce. I had a 2-year-old daughter who I adored. My wife had an affair and moved in. My daughter and ex-wife of 12 hours, I found it the next day, moved in with my sponsee and best friend. One of my favorite sponsees. And it was just, I was insane. And I was getting through that by this process and the steps and, you know, helping people and doing 12-step work as AA implies. And I was getting through it. I was surviving it. But the hardest thing about it was I missed my daughter. Now, I had the legal ability to see her. I just didn't know if I had the emotional ability. Because in order to see her, I got to go where they live. Right? And I don't know if I can do it. I'm just jacked up inside about it. But I missed her. I love my daughter. I held her. She cried her first tears in my arms. I gave her a first bath in the delivery room. It was she stole my heart. So I eventually the heartache overcame my fear and resentments, and I went over and picked her up for the day and spent a whole day with her. And as I'm taking and we're at this ranch. And she got to ride ponies, and she loved that. She's just a little kid. We had to hold her on the pony. These little Shetland ponies. We had to hold her and take her around the corral. We're done. We're sitting there, and I leave her with the woman that works there, and I go over to the stables to get some cans of soda pop, and I'm coming back across the yard, and I hear the woman who works there say, Kate, here comes your dad. And Kate looks up and goes, that's not my daddy. Craig's my daddy. And, she don't know what she's saying, but it cut me. It cut me in here. And I pushed those feelings down, you know, like we learn on those streets. And I spent the rest of the day with my daughter. I took her home that night for dinner. We drive up to where they're living together, and I take her by the hand. We walk up and ring the doorbell, and the happy couple answers the door, and she jumps into his arms. And I turn around and walk back to my car. And I get my car, and I drive about a block away. And I had to pull over. I was coming apart. And I'm in the car, and I'm sobbing and talking to God at the same time. And what I'm saying to God is I'm telling him, I am sorry. I love my daughter, but I can't see her anymore. This hurts too much. I'm not big enough for this. And it's killing me. And I look at the clock on the dashboard, and I promised this idiot guy I'm sponsoring that I'd meet him at the AA clubhouse, the SOS club on Main Street, and take him across town to a step study. And I don't want to meet him. I really need to go home and think is what I really need to do. But, you know, you guys have ruined me. You do what you say you're going to do and show up where you say you're going to. You know, you ruined me with that stuff. So I'm barreling across town. I get the guy in the car, and we're heading to the step study. He's not even in that car but a couple minutes, a minute or two maybe, and he starts crying as he tells me that he'd been denied by the courts once again to see his kids. And I'm looking at him, and I know that there's only one person on this planet that can stop me from seeing my daughter, and that's me. And I made the decision to see her again next week, and then next week. And she is the light of my life. We've been all over the world together. We've been to cruises. We've scuba dived together in the Hawaiian Islands and in the Caribbean. She's the love of my life, most important relationship. And the new guy thought I was helping him. If you don't step up, I think you're tying God's hands, because the helper gets the help here. if you come here and you don't transition into being willing to be of service and willing to sponsor people, we got nothing. We don't got much for you here. Alcoholics Anonymous is an altruistic movement. Our primary, number one, primary purpose is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. That is transitory, because most of us come here and our primary purpose is ourselves. And no wonder I'm so full of anxiety and depression. No wonder I don't fit anywhere. No wonder I feel separate and alone and apart from, because someone wrapped up in themselves makes a very small package. No wonder I don't fit out here, because when you're wrapped up in yourself, you don't live out here. You live up here. And you guys showed me a way to free me from the bondage of self. And that's through service and 12-step work. I'm going to get off the plane tonight. I got my car at the airport. I'm going to run across town. A guy I sponsored, that Kent sponsored for one time, for a while when he was in Vegas, is celebrating 5 years. There'll be about 20 or more people I sponsor in this really high-end restaurant. We're going to make a big shindig, and I'll probably be there till midnight, and I am really tired. But I'll bet that I get energy the minute I'm with those people, right? I will get lit up, because that's what you do. Wilson says the step 12 is the joy of living step. It is what keeps me going and energizes me and gives me vitality. Anyway, that's all I got. Thanks.